Thank you all for being here. My name is Dean Reuter. I am Vice President at the Federalist Society and the Director of the Practice Groups. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your patience as we begin our first panel this morning. I was going to give opening remarks of about 30 minutes, and I will trim those down so you really lost nothing here this morning. I am the director, as I said, of 15 practice groups. We only have 15 practice groups at the Federalist Society, and property rights, including IP rights, are prominently featured in our work and in our study. One entire practice group is devoted to intellectual property. Another is devoted to environmental law and property rights, what some people might refer to as more traditional or concrete property rights, rights in real property and tangible chattel. A third practice group is devoted to corporations, securities, and antitrust, and we spend a fair amount of energy exploring the law and policy at the intersection of IP rights and antitrust. These are important and interesting issues for us, especially in our technology-driven economy, and we hope to learn a great deal today from our two panel discussions and from our address by Professor Richard Epstein. To begin, we have a panel that will be moderated by Judge Paul Michel. It's my honor to introduce him. Let me say at the outset, this panel will probably go a little bit long, as I mentioned in an earlier note, and eat into our break. We'll try to begin our subsequent panel about on time, maybe a few minutes late, and eat into the second break, and then begin lunch on time. But as I say, for this morning's panel, Judge Michel is our moderator. He served on the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit for 22 years, from the end of 2004 until his retirement on May 31st of 2010. He was the court's chief judge and a member of the Judicial Conference of the United States. He's the recipient of the Jefferson Medal, the Federico Award, the Katz-Kiley Prize, the Eli Whitney Prize, the Sedona Conference Lifetime Achievement Award, and many other awards. He's been named one of the 50 most influential leaders in intellectual property in the world by Managing Intellectual Property Magazine, and he's been inducted into the Intellectual Asset Management Magazine's International Hall of Fame. Now, in his life, he conducts mediations, arbitrations, mock trials, moot courts, and case evaluations in IP cases as a consultant, and to our good fortune, he also does some public speaking and moderates panels. And with that, Judge Michel.
Thank you so much, Dean, and good morning, everyone. I have to congratulate the Federalist Society for organizing and hosting this conference. It deals with issues of extraordinary importance to the country, short-term, mid-term, and long-term as well. And it couldn't be better timed because there is so much going on. With the new Congress convening in mid-January, there will be I expect very heightened activity on aggressive legislation, and much is going on at the Federal Trade Commission, at the White House, at the Patent Office, and elsewhere. In addition to the level of intense activity that's accelerating still further in the coming weeks, a great deal, I suggest, has changed in just the last 2 years with the America Invents Act beginning to be implemented just over 2 years ago in 2012, the fall of 2012. Changes are still being felt and are hard to fully measure, but early results show a very changed picture in terms of enforceability of patents, in terms of speed and cost and outcomes, with 80% of the patents challenged back at the patent office, or at least the claims, 80% of the claims being invalidated. So there'll be many things we'll discuss this morning, and there'll be a chance, of course, for all of you to ask questions, which we would very much enjoy. I'm honored this morning to be able to try to facilitate and moderate this very fine panel. You'll hear first from Director Alden Abbott from the Heritage Foundation. He has a very interesting background. You have a little bit of it in your handout for this morning's program. But I'll tell you a few other things that would be perhaps very interesting to you. One is that he was formerly the director at the Federal Trade Commission of antitrust policy. He also is the author of a well-known blog, which I'll give a little plug to it because I think it's got exactly the right title and the right focus. It's called Truth in the Market. He's a graduate of University of Virginia, undergraduate, master's in economics at Georgetown University, JD at Harvard Law School, has held important fellowships at Harvard Law School, All Souls College at Oxford University, widely published, and his most recent stint before April 2014 when he joined the Heritage Foundation as the deputy director of the Edwin Meese Legal and Judicial Studies operation there was as the head of patent and antitrust strategy at BlackBerry. I'm actually a customer, so I especially appreciate that. Commissioner Joshua D. Wright started at the Federal Trade Commission nearly 2 years ago in January of 2013, and his term will extend to 2019. So he will be a key player going forward, as of course he already is. Like Mr. Abbott, he has an association, but on a full-time basis, before joining the commission at the George Mason University Law School. And like many people there, and like Mr. Abbott, he has thought and led and written a great deal at the intersection of economics, patents, and antitrust. And it's a territory that's not, I think, as well understood as it should be. A few things about Commissioner Wright that you might not know that I found particularly interesting is that his arrival at the commission in January of 2013 was his fourth stint at the Federal Trade Commission. He held two internships going back some, and he was the initial scholar in residence in 2007 and 8 at the Bureau of Competition. So his ascension to the commission is his fourth go at the Federal Trade Commission. So lots of expertise, lots of background. He's a Californian through and through. I don't know how we lured him to the East Coast, but I'm awfully glad we did because he plays a very important role. Born in San Diego, undergraduate at the University of California in San Diego, JD at UCLA, still of course in California, PhD in economics right after his law degree, has taught at Pepperdine, again in California, in the public policy area, so very versatile. Antitrust, economics, public policy, law. He's the co-editor of the Supreme Court Economic Review, which is, in my opinion, a very important publication. So these two men have fabulous backgrounds. Just a couple observations before turning to Mr. Abbott, who will start things off. I mentioned how much has changed recently, but it's not only the implementation of the America Invents Act, it's also a series of actions at the White House, that have driven actions at the Patent Office. The Supreme Court has been very active just in the last 7 or 8 months. A handful of very major decisions, Octane Fitness, Highmark, Nautilus, Alice, dealing with fee shifting, claim clarity, claim definiteness, and eligibility for patenting. So huge changes at the hands of the Supreme Court, impending changes again, second round at the hands of the Congress. Much is going on in the judiciary. The new bills address patent litigation, but the judiciary has been moving to revise its rules on discovery, on details and pleadings, and on other provisions. There's also a very active program known as the Patent Pilot Program, where volunteer judges in numerous districts, 14 in all, specialize in patent cases and therefore develop rather rapidly considerable expertise in their management. So we have a lot going on, a lot has changed, but in my opinion, the debate about optimizing patent policy, whether at the patent granting stage or the patent enforcement stage or the licensing business stage or any other stage, has not been what it needs to be if the country is to have a secure and happy economic future. So I, again, congratulate all of you for being here, Heritage and our host, Federalist Society, for organizing this gathering. You know, the policy debate, in part, has been so poor because it's been the result of massive PR and what I would even characterize as propaganda, bottom line oriented by a small number of companies, a couple dozen, and it has featured language that maybe as a crusty old judge I find unhelpful and sometimes almost juvenile. So you hear all about trolls, and you hear about patent thickets, and you hear about holdup, and you hear about low quality patents, and on and on and on. So that's not a very elevated debate. We'll try to work on that. A couple words about patents. Of course, patents are property. The essence of property is that it's sellable, exploitable. Second thing about patents is they're not self-enforcing, so they only have value to the extent that courts can and will enforce them in a way that's timely, affordable, and with reasonable predictability. It's another observation about patents is that it's sometimes said that their purpose is to encourage inventors. It does have that purpose, but I would put it pretty low on the list. To me, the most important value of patents is to incentivize investment in research and development and then the commercialization of new products and services. That takes a lot of money almost always. So the people to be motivated by patents are the capital managers who are either going to invest in R&D or not, depending on whether there's a reasonable assurance of a reasonable return. And of course, the most important perspective and the essence of our frame of reference here today is what are the international implications of what we do as a country, both in the executive branch, in the judiciary, and in the legislative branch around patent policy. How will it affect our global competitiveness? How will it affect our prosperity? What about job creation? What about the development of new cures for serious diseases? There's an awful lot at stake. And there's a question, too, and this is essentially my final point about migration. You know, in the decades after World War II, there was a massive brain drain out of the United Kingdom and much of Europe in favor of America, and we benefited hugely from that. I'm a little worried that we may have a reverse brain drain if we mess up patent policy sufficiently so that firms that are now here will move overseas or move their R&D operations overseas. There are some big advantages to doing so. Things that are not eligible under recent Supreme Court decisions in the United States for patenting are eligible, broadly eligible, in Europe. The courts in Germany and England, for example, are 5 times faster, 10 times cheaper, and 100 times more predictable in the outcomes than the courts here. So we have a lot at stake, a lot at risk, and we need to have a series of private actors who can better inform the Congress and its staff so that we can optimize policy instead of do things that may turn out to be very harmful and counterproductive. So with that, we'll turn to Alden Abbott for getting us started.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and thank you very much, Judge Michel, for your overly generous introduction. I will start out by saying the views I express are my own, however, I suspect there are lots of my colleagues who are in sync. Patent policy is enormously important and a real concern, and it was indirectly alluded to, I think, by Judge Michel, is that a bipartisan consensus had emerged, I believe, by the mid-1990s in favor of a restrained application of the antitrust laws to patents, strong support for patenting, and this was not ideological, Republican versus Democrat. It was belief that strong intellectual property rights benefit the American economy. They benefit us internationally. They create the sorts of incentives Judge Michel mentioned for investment and economic growth. Regrettably, it's my view that in recent years that consensus has been shattered by some ill-advised policies by public policymakers who, with the best of intentions, may unfortunately be weakening our first-rate patent system. So let's look a little bit at history. In the 1960s and 1970s, there was a lot of suspicion in the federal courts of patents. They were typically characterized as monopolies. And indeed, the Justice Department, in a list of licensing practices called the nine no-nos, said, we believe that all of these restrictive licensing practices that we're going to put on this list are presumptively illegal. This was a famous speech by Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Antitrust Division. These were typically practices, and I won't go down the list, you can find it, that restricted forms of distribution or placed various restraints on what licensees could do regarding the scope of the license, uses of technology. But the key to all of these nine no-nos is they really dealt with so-called vertical practices. That is, with not competing technologies, not competing patents, but how can a particular licensee utilize my patent? And in the 1981, the Justice Department made a 180-degree turn and said, no, we think lots of these practices, in the economist jargon, put together complements, that they're efficient, that there's reasons why, for example, a patentee might want to place limits on the scope of a license and the particular use of a patent by different licensees. That could encourage the licensees to develop the technology, to use it best, and it would be in their interest to do that. At the same time, you weren't reducing competition because what you were doing was, in effect, within the scope of the patent itself. That is, there was no power beyond the scope of whatever market power existed in the patent that was being exploited. And that position really was formalized and accepted in a set of 1995 guidelines during the Clinton administration. And in fact, Rich Gilbert, a prominent economist, well thought of, Democratic appointee, was sort of the administration's chief antitrust economist, was very responsible for that list for the 1995 guidelines. And the 1995 guidelines, basically, there are four major points I want you to remember, and probably a lot of you are familiar with these points. They concluded that the IP laws, first of all, the big principle, and antitrust share common purpose of promoting innovation and enhancing consumer welfare. Four general principles. One, for the purpose of antitrust analysis, IP is essentially comparable to any other form of property. Obviously, property is used differently. Each piece of property, such as a car, is different than real estate, for example. But within that, this is property. This is not a monopoly. Two, it will not be presumed that IP creates market power, that is, the ability to restrict output and raise price above the competitive levels for a significant period of time. In other words, there's no presumption it is a monopoly. And indeed, the Supreme Court basically accepted that position 8 years ago in the Independent Inc. case, in a tying arrangement case in which it said when a party ties one patented service or product has a patent service or product and uses that and ties it to sort of a complementary product, You're not going to assume that the patent gives you market power. You are going to have to prove up that there's market power in the patent. In this case, there was a patented ink copier machine, and ink cartridges were tied to that machine. So no presumption of market power. Why? Sort of common sense. There are many competing machines. For instance, you might have a patented wrench, many competing wrenches. In some cases, you'll have market power, but in most cases, you won't. Number three, IP licensing, as I already mentioned, allows firms to combine complementary factors of production and is generally pro-competitive. And number four, antitrust concerns may arise when a licensing arrangement harms competition among entities that would have been actual or likely potential competitors in a relevant market in the absence of the license. Generally speaking, this focuses on competition among different patents, not exploiting the whatever market power may exist within a patent through purely vertical relationships. And by the way, some patents do confer market power, but the philosophy of the guidelines said, even in those cases, it's perfectly okay to exploit whatever market power inheres in a patent, and in fact, that is quite consistent with Justice Scalia's famous statement for unanimous court in Trinco, Verizon v. Trinco in 2004, where he wrote, the mere possession of monopoly power and concomitant charging of monopoly prices is not only not unlawful, it is an important element of the free market system. The opportunity to charge monopoly prices, at least for a short period, is what attracts business acumen in the first place. It induces risk-taking that produces innovation and economic growth. To safeguard the incentive to innovate, possession of monopoly power will not be found unlawful unless it is accompanied by an element of anti-competitive conduct. Okay, so what happened? The Federal Trade Commission and really started investigating the intersection between patent and antitrust policy, produced a 2003 report in which it said it was important to take into account an appropriate balance between patents and antitrust. A lot of the report dealt with alleged defects in the administrative processes of the Patent Office and of the patent system as a whole. There are some commentators, including National Academy of Sciences, seem to indicate there were merits in these administrative improvements. Whatever one thinks about that, what arguably was troubling, there were some initial references to a balance, somehow suggesting that it might be appropriate to weaken the patent property right through the application of antitrust. There was also reference to potentially weak and poor quality patents, to patent thickets when many patents, say, can cover one component of a product, say, semiconductor chip, that might make it difficult to cross-license or might lead to excessive, quote-unquote, royalties, stacking, due to the stacking of all of these patents. I'll skip briefly before going to a 2007 report to 2011, when the Federal Trade Commission went beyond this, raised the problem of so-called patent trolls as significant. And interestingly, in looking at damages in a patent infringement suit, said damages should be measured by the ex ante, before any licensing took place, say, determine the difference between the technology and the next best technology, what royalty difference there would have been. So if you, now the problem with that is if several technologies are competing and one is chosen, and you say, well, the license value, say, would have been 0.01%, the value between the royalty license of the first and second technology, misapplication or arguably straightforward application of that principle could lead to very, very low royalty payments and create disincentives to patenting, at least in my view. Now, there was a 2007 report that in large part reconfirmed the findings of the 1995 Justice Department FTC report. I mentioned its four conclusions. It also talked about patent pools, standard setting, a few new areas which hadn't been focused on earlier, and, you know, properly so, pooling and standard setting raised the potential of competing patents and issues that may arise and that may be raised in that context. A real problem, though, where is the problem? The problem is this notion that was developed about a decade ago by some scholars of that patents are probabilistic patent rights, which means that a lot of them are weak. You don't know whether they'll be upheld ex ante ahead of time. That somehow suggests that because of the low quality of the patents, one should be perhaps more willing to make antitrust attacks on some patenting arrangements. And indeed, there's been, I think, a focus, and Commissioner Wright will hit some of these, on unilateral exercise of patents, you know, whether in pharmaceuticals, that's sort of a separate area, but particularly in the area of standard setting, efforts by patentees to obtain returns on patents committed to a standard, so-called standard essential patents. My concern is that this whole focus now has been more and more on unilateral exercise of the patent right, constraining unilateral returns to patents, not worried about competing patents. And this focus on constraining unilateral returns is antithetical, in my view, to the philosophy, the bipartisan philosophy that had been expressed in the 1995 guidelines, and consistent with Judge Michel's views. I think that that may well undermine incentives to commercialize, which I agree with him is perhaps the most important incentive, because if there are on the margin fewer incentives to patent, there will be fewer opportunities to commercialize based on patenting. And I'll stop right now and turn the podium over to Commissioner Wright.
Thanks, Alden. So, I have a microphone in front of me, which means I say the things that are about to come out of my mouth belong to me and not the commission. That's what happens when I get a microphone. So, I think Alden set up very nicely, I think, some of the key points in the sort of historical arc of the intersection between antitrust and IP, and particularly as it relates to the Federal Trade Commission. I want to focus really on two points. One is when Alden went through the 1995 guidelines that came out of the Federal Trade Commission and summarized their conclusions. One of them was what I refer to as the symmetry principle, but is that real property rights and intellectual property rights are in parity with respect to application of the antitrust laws. That, I think, is an incredibly key bit of that antitrust and IP consensus that plays an important role in sort of, in addition to the reasons that Alden stated, sort of two things that I want to point out before sort of getting to the larger patent and antitrust issue as it relates to the Federal Trade Commission. One of the, I think, underappreciated benefits of what I'll just refer to as the symmetry principle, is that it rejected the view that we should have analytical or intellectual shortcuts for figuring out the competitive effects of transactions involving IP rights. One of the big gains of antitrust law over the past 50 years was allowing economic analysis to be sort of the lodestar that guided decision making. And it corrected a lot of things in the antitrust law that rendered it subject to a great amount of criticism in the 60s and 70s in particular, in sort of righting the ship in a number of areas by putting economic analysis first. The parity principle, or the symmetry principle, I think tethers the analysis of IP rights to that more general trend. There have been many invitations from the academic community, from policymakers themselves, from firms that come and see the agencies and hoping that they can get them to act in one way or another. But many invitations to substitute sort of shortcut methods, to presume, as Alden discussed, to presume that intellectual property rights confer market power without an empirical showing, to presume that typical types of transactions that we observe in the real property setting as pro-competitive are anti-competitive in the intellectual property rights setting. Through the 90s and even you know, to date, at least in the Supreme Court, both the Supreme Court and through the 90s, the antitrust agencies rejected those invitations. And I think that that has been a highly beneficial thing for the economic analysis of transactions involving IP rights. And I think that is one understated but very important benefit of the symmetry principle announced in the 95 guidelines, and something that is at stake where there are deviations from that symmetry principle. I agree with Alden. I think that the symmetry principle in particular, perhaps among other things in that 1995 consensus, have been discarded, if not at least forgotten. I'll return to that in a moment, but I do think it's important in laying out the stakes of deviating from the symmetry principle to get that it is in some ways an attack on a lot of the progress that's been made in antitrust with respect to putting economic analysis first. Another point that is at stake that sort of instead of waiting to the end to talk about involves the international implications of deviating from the symmetry principle. In 30 years ago, there were something like, you could count the number of antitrust regimes with your fingers 30 years ago. Now you would need a lot of fingers and have to invite some friends over. There are 100 and something in the emerging antitrust community. Some of these communities with antitrust regimes have sort of a long tradition of respect for property rights. They value well-defined and robustly enforced property rights. Other countries in the growing antitrust community have no tradition to speak of at all with respect to property rights. If antitrust is to contribute to the global economy rather than detract from it by facilitating innovation and competition and economic growth, I think an important point, and a point I think understood fairly well within the agency, is that the important idea among these sort of growing regimes is convergence on the ideal of using economic analysis to guide competition policy, and that that idea is far more achievable, both in the short term and at least the medium term, than convergence across legal institutions with widely varied cultures. Legal institutions and cultures respect borders far more than the law of supply or the law of demand. And I think getting convergence on the economic analysis is probably the most important thing, lest we inadvertently send a message to other jurisdictions around the world that it is okay or that it is consistent with an antitrust policy that fosters economic growth to devalue property rights. So I think those are, just sort of to put a point on Alden's introduction to the topic, two of the things that are at stake in the global sense and in the sense for antitrust sort of writ large in getting the IP space done correctly. My background before I came to the commission is as an economist and a lawyer, and I did a lot of empirical work. Tried to relate that empirical work to public policy topics, usually in the antitrust space. I think it is worth thinking about where the evidence stands in the patent holdup debate. I mean, one of the main motivators within regulatory agencies, and certainly within the regulatory agency where I work at the FTC, when thinking about various restrictions that might be imposed on a patent holder's ability to use the patent, to enforce the patent, and so forth, is the fear of patent holdup. That is, the fear that after investments are sunk, a patent holder may use an injunction to extract super competitive royalties. It may, after investments have been sunk. The idea that private parties may try to wait until investments are sunk to take advantage of each other is an old one in economics. It's not special in the IP space. Oliver Williamson has a nice medal from Sweden, largely for figuring this stuff out. Okay, and others have been thinking about the problem of holdup and how to deal with it and how private parties transact with one another, deal with one another, use reputation and other private ordering mechanisms to deal with holdup. So it's a space where you've got competing but well-understood theory. I mean, you can get economists of all stripes in a room, understand the patent holdup literature, understand its analytical roots. You also have issues to be concerned with, as the holdup literature in the real property space recognize with respect to reverse holdup. Now, the normal, I think, sort of evidence-based approach to having competing theory in a public policy space is to examine the competing predictions of the theory and run them against the data. Right? Get all the data you can get, line up the competing predictions, and see who wins the horse race, and develop your regulatory policy against that backdrop and with the benefit of those data. There are, I think impressive in some ways and disturbing in some other ways about the patent holdup debate is that I think Alden started his tale of the history from the nine no-nos and through a variety of FTC reports. There have been reports from other people. There have been 100 academic articles on the prospect and theory of holdup and reverse holdup and so forth and so on. And we are a decade at least, into a heated debate on the topic. And the empirical evidence, the ratio of theory to empirics, is incredibly high, disturbingly high. So really basic questions that from an empirical perspective that you would want to know the answer to before you developed some sort of regulatory policy that we don't know the answers to, taking an objective look at sort of the systematic economic evidence that exists in the world. How often does it happen? Both hold up and reverse hold up. What are the welfare consequences when it does happen? Really basic stuff. This is like the math you would need to know to calculate how big of a problem this is, how much time it's worth, whether other institutions, contract law, doctrines within patent law, are capable of handling these things without the antitrust hammer is a question of interest on my end. What about standard setting organization contracts? Right? So these are big, sophisticated parties. They get held up. They learn. The contract terms change. How often do they change? How do they change? Do they change in favor only of patent holders? Do they change in favor of implementers? What's that process look like? Okay. Is that process and the sort of institution of contract sufficient to deter patent holdup out there in the wild? These are four questions I think are sort of, these are basic things. I'd like to know more than that, but these are basic things where in some areas we know nothing, literally nothing. And in other areas we have a little bit of anecdote or descriptive data. And so in large part, I think a tale of the patent holdup debate is in some sense a debate that's sort of gotten way ahead of the data. This is also not a problem that is patent specific. It happens elsewhere, and there are anecdotes for it. One thing I would like to say about the sort of a special feature of this debate is that it has taken place sort of not only in the academic journals and now in the regulatory agencies. So sort of how far, when we say we've departed from or maybe lost the symmetry principle, sort of how far have things gone? Before I came to the Federal Trade Commission, and these are cases I wrote about before I started, did I mention my own views and not the commission? A couple of cases, the FTC has Section 5 settlements under its unfair methods of competition authority with Google, with Bosch, a case against NData that sort of goes back to 2007, all of which stand for the proposition or propositions that a patent holder, standard essential patent holder asserting an injunction on its patent without more can violate the antitrust laws, and in particular the unfair methods of competition provision in Section 5 of the FTC Act. You will not find any case involving real property rights in which such a proposition is asserted, and for very good reason. But I think that sort of deviation, in particular the use of Section 5, the unfair methods prohibition within, the unfair methods provision within the FTC, to do so where there is virtually no law, we get consents and so forth, and so very difficult to challenge, is developing patent policy through, I think, a fairly questionable tool. And so now we sort of get this body of settlements in which it is apparently the view of the FTC, or at least you can point to settlements suggesting as much, that the assertion of an injunction by itself without more violates the antitrust laws. That, I think, suggests this is not just an academic problem. There are enforcement actions taking place. There are practitioners counseling clients that they can't assert injunctions on their standard essential patents without knowing whether such a rule makes the world, from an evidence-based perspective, a better or worse place. I think that is a particularly dangerous approach, and I think it's an approach that has been contrary to the tradition of the agency where I work. One of the wonderful things about the FTC, the judge was kind enough to mention I'd been there 4 times. You don't go anywhere 4 times unless you like it, not even a restaurant, much less a place of employment. And one of the things that I think makes the FTC a special place as a regulatory agency is that it is a building full of talented people, but in addition to that, it's full of talented people and economists and policymakers that I think have had a tradition of caring deeply about what the data says the right policy is. Our merger guidelines that evolved from the 1968 to 2010, the courts hadn't recognized an efficiency defense for parties. Parties couldn't come into court and say, the merger will lower my costs, that's why we're merging and that's good for consumers. We are an enforcement agency that put an efficiency defense into our guidelines when courts wouldn't do it. We're not an agency that has traditionally sort of just done things that make it easier for us to win. And I think one of the sort of commitments to data, the use of our 6B authority. We have a PAE study coming now, but we've sort of traditionally been very sensitive to what the empirical data says, sometimes gone out and got it ourselves before developing policy. On this one, I think it's fairly clear that the agency has not done that. And I think that is disturbing for reasons to do with, you know, believing evidence should drive policy generally, but in an area where, because we're talking about patents and innovation and economic growth, an area where the stakes just couldn't be higher. So I will stop there.
Thank you. Let me put 3 new issues on the table to stimulate questions from all of you out there and also comments from your panelists. First of all, as one from the legal world, from the courts, it always sort of startles me when people talk about, well, the patent owner is going to threaten me with an injunction. A patent owner doesn't have the power of injunctions. Only judges grant injunctions, and in recent times, they mostly don't grant injunctions if there's any reason to doubt the soundness of the outcomes. So this idea that injunctions are a club that any patent owner can bash somebody over the head with is just a wildly exaggerated notion. The same thing with regard to the threat of a lawsuit. People say, well, the patent owner is going to threaten to sue me. Well, they might, and they might even file a lawsuit because you don't need too much more than the filing fee to file a lawsuit. But the fact that a lawsuit is filed doesn't mean anything is going to happen. If the patent is invalid, it will get invalidated. If it's not being infringed, there'll be no liability. So the fact that somebody can threaten to file a lawsuit is not as big a gorilla as it's sometimes made out to be. So part of the problem for policymakers on Capitol Hill or at the Trade Commission or elsewhere is that you have to understand so many different things: antitrust law, competition policy, patent law, litigation, economics, and on and on and on, and there are very few people who have expertise in all of those areas. So it looks to me like the policymakers need input from people who are expert in each of those areas, but it won't always be the same people. So the realities of litigation, the difficulty of getting an injunction under current legal practices is one issue that I throw out. Secondly, the patent system, I mentioned, is viewed by many as being mainly to encourage inventors as opposed to investors, where I say the bigger need is investors. But the other thing the patent system is not widely understood, is that it's a system for sharing technology. Because to get a patent, you have to fully disclose what you invented and how it works so as to equip other people to be able to practice that invention, usually after they get a license, and to invent around it, developing new innovations that are outside the scope of the patent protection. So it's a sharing system, and it's hugely beneficial. And then we need to consider, what are the alternatives? If we so restrain the acquisition or assertion of patents through new public policy, what will innovators do? What are their options? The main option is keep it all secret. Make it a trade secret in all the cases where that can be maintained. It's not 100%, but in many cases, trade secrets are the option to patents. If it's a trade secret, the technology doesn't get shared. If it's patented, the technology gets shared with everybody. Third notion, and this is again focusing on the international front, if antitrust authorities in the United States severely restrain the options of patent owners here in America, what is this going to do to the practices in important other markets? Take China, for example. If we severely restrict the enforceability or the license, the leasability, I'll say, of patents here, what will Chinese authorities be emboldened to do to the disadvantage of American companies trying to do business there? So all of our actions have big consequences, not only here in America, but in all of the important markets all around the globe. So it's a very complicated picture. You need to see all the puzzle pieces, and you need to see how they fit together before you can make sensible policy. At least that's my view. Alden, what do you think?
Well, I think these are all very good points, Judge Michel. Starting with your last point, internationally, I know Commissioner Olhausen, Commissioner Wright's colleague, has spoken in China and raised particular concerns because, in fact, these settlements by the FTC on the Google settlement, Standard Essential Patent case, was described in positive tones but mischaracterized by some Chinese officials who said, well, patents are monopolies, and who suggested that there is an essential facilities doctrine in the United States, which means that a patentee has to give access by order of the government to other parties to the patent on fair terms. There's a big concern that the Chinese were saying this in a way to suggest we want access to foreign companies' patents. Many companies, Qualcomm, InterDigital, just to name a few, who have been subject of antitrust-related investigations in China, and there's a concern that a very low patent licensing fee might be the result, and that would create disincentives to invest. And that, again, Commissioner Olhausen tried to straighten out the Chinese officials, but I think the whole tone of some of these FTC settlements, despite what the best efforts of Commissioner Olhausen and later Chairwoman Ramirez to say, oh no, we're not saying anything negative about patents, may not be fully effective, because instead I would submit that in the 1980s and 90s, when the U.S. was negotiating trade-related intellectual property agreement, World Trade Organization, in which it was going overseas and urging strong support for intellectual property rights. Of course, this was before China had any antitrust laws. You didn't see this sort of blowback. So I think the tone of this focus on alleged excessive returns to patents injunction is a real problem.
You know, it is a commitment of standard essential patent contributors that they have to agree to license their patents in a non-discriminatory way, meaning on equal terms and to anybody, and for reasonable rates. But of course, what a reasonable rate is, to some extent, is in the eye of the beholder and not so easy to know without a tremendous amount of factual inquiry. So when people say, well, owners of standard essential patents are getting excessive royalties and increasing the potential royalties by engaging in litigation, it assumes what's in controversy. It assumes that it's an unreasonable amount that they're getting or seeking. It seemed to me that Commissioner Wright is exactly correct that policy to be an instrument of social benefit, economic progress, technological leadership has to be based on facts, because otherwise, how do you associate causes with effects? If you don't have facts and you don't measure, you're in the realm of philosophy or religion. You're assuming certain things are true, as opposed to being able to demonstrate that they're true. So there's a tremendous amount of assertion. Claims are made, often in very extreme form, and if you look to see what the factual foundation is, it's often meager, and sometimes it looks to me like it's actually non-existent. Commissioner, what do you think about that?
So I think I agree with the part about you agreeing with me, for sure. But sort of moreover, I think it's important, I think, to have some perspective on how significant the deviation from policy is. I think if one were sort of to open up, a standard industrial organization economics text, or heck, open up Adam Smith and say, what are the things that I sort of learn about basic economic conventional wisdom? I mean, you could come up with more than two things, but two pretty high on your list would be specialization's good, and property rights are pretty darned important. And those things have been at the core of the symmetry principle, about getting it integrated by the agencies in a sort of bipartisan and consensus fashion, and in correcting what was, I mean, when Alden described the nine no-nos era, this was virtually anything that you would ever want to do with patents was illegal, is the sort of shorthand version of the nine no-nos. And that is gone. And it is a Supreme Court decision that unanimously says, also, patents don't confer market power. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, just like real property rights. If you want to win an antitrust case, prove it. And this is the way that it should be to ensure that we're not condemning pro-competitive business practices in innovation. I think with respect to some of the sort of modern trends in this area, much of the troll PAE debate is framed in the form of an attack on specialization, right? So these are firms that do one thing, but they don't do another thing. These are guys who assert and, license, but they don't make. Well, normally we think about that as a form of specialization, and there are some forms of specialization that are bad, like bank robbery, okay? That's bad. But we have, we know that's bad. We probably know that's bad without data. That might be one exception, okay? But we don't know that with respect to the things that PAE specialize in doing. There is an assertion, we are sort of assuming the facts into the record, that assertion is bad. Well, why is assertion from a PAE bad? Well, because they're going to get an injunction. From whom is one question, okay? And is that a credible threat? But moreover, what are the effects of that specialization? I'd argue in most contexts, we begin with the default presumption that specialization is good for a reason that I think goes to the success of PR campaigns more and academics more than anything else. That presumption has been overturned in some important places. And I think the anecdote to that is a commitment from regulatory agencies in particular to let the data drive policy discussions more than, in my view, that is happening today.
You know, in addition to letting facts, data drive policymaking, it seems to me that policymakers should discriminate between abusive or harmful actions versus classes of actors. So, for example, if we assume that all patent assertion entities are engaged in intolerable abusive behaviors, I think the facts wouldn't support that. There may be some that do, but they don't all. I would say probably most don't, and therefore your status as a PAE doesn't reveal anything very important. Are you a PAE who is engaging in abusive litigation, or are you a PAE that's running a licensing program backed up, as is necessarily the case, by court action on a selective basis? Seems to me it makes a big difference. The same thing about plaintiffs. The Congress seems to have been sold the idea that most patent lawsuits are frivolous, and that therefore most plaintiffs are bad people who are causing harm. It looks, as far as I can tell, the evidence suggests that there are some abusive plaintiffs, but somebody's status as a plaintiff doesn't tell you anything important. They may be engaged in perfectly proper behavior, or they may be engaged in questionable behavior, but you have to look at the behavior. You can't look at the status or class of the person or the entity and reach any kind of sensible policy conclusion. It's a little bit like associating cause and effect, relying on data to see what actually happens. You have to look at behavior, not status, if you're going to have any kind of sensible policy. At least that's what the way it looks to me. Maybe we should see if those of you who have listened so attentively so far have questions, because your two panelists or even your moderator have had a chance to unburden views, and we'd be very interested in trying to address what's on your mind. So come forth with questions, identify yourself briefly, and then succinctly put your question to our panel. Yes, sir.
Hi. Mike Waring with the University of Michigan. Commissioner Wright, the FTC recently, I believe, took action against a troll for doing some troll-like behavior. There's legislation in Congress that would essentially encourage you to do more of that as the real way to get at people who are bad actors who send out these demand letters to hundreds of banks or hundreds of small businesses claiming there's some kind of patent violation, wanting a fee, threatening to go to court, and so forth and so on. Is that an appropriate response by the FTC? Would that be a good way to focus there as opposed to litigation reform? What should be the role of FTC in dealing with that sort of behavior?
Thanks. I appreciate the question. Now, that case is based upon our deception authority on the consumer protection side. So it is not the issuance of the letters themselves. It's that it's the deceptive statements are the conduct that violates the consumer protection law. And excuse me. And I think that that's a traditional job of the Federal Trade Commission. It's one we do well. And it's one that we have as the case suggests, that we have authority that exists to do. I don't have any particular dog in the fight with respect to whether we should be doing more or less. We should enforce the law that we have and do it well, and I think we do it very well. When we find deceptive statements, including by some of these bad actors, I think maybe the way where your question was going was that it is a more targeted response to when people talk about public policy problems involving what they describe as trolls or PAEs or whatever term is now in vogue. I think a lot of that behavior is what folks have in mind, and oftentimes the description is trickier because we're really talking about an extremely heterogeneous set of firms and activities, which is another reason not to talk about the status of the firms, because troll means different things to a lot of different people and also describes a whole different class of activities. But I think that approach of attacking deceptive statements made in commerce within our jurisdiction is a target approach. It is one that we can be fairly sure makes things better, not worse. There are not a lot of serious economic arguments that inserting more deception into the economy is good for it. So I think we're on fairly safe ground there. I think the more dangerous extension is the antitrust sort of competition side of the house, where you know, predicate to any finding of a violation is a showing of consumer harm, a showing of anti-competitive effect. And it is there where I think this sort of temptation to allow theory to substitute for data is doing some damage.
Two facts with regard to so-called demand letters. One is that every one of the Fortune 500 companies that owns patents, which is virtually all of them, send out demand letters. And they do it responsibly in virtually every case. So the fact that somebody sends a demand letter is not a badge that they're a bad or irresponsible actor. Some demand letters can be irresponsible, can be deceptive, and should be restrained. And that brings the second point. It's so appropriate. Here we are with the Federalist Society. There's a big Federalist issue here, because enforcement to protect consumers occurs at the state level as well as at the federal level. And as probably most of you know, several dozen states' attorneys general have become very active with respect to seemingly abusive demand letters. So there's a lot happening at the state level, which should be part of the calculus in deciding how much more, if any more, the federal actor, the Federal Trade Commission, needs to engage in. What do you think about this demand letter problem, Alden?
I think you're quite right, Judge. In fact, I remember a lot of state attorneys general have expressed, as you indicated, an interest in pursuing under their little FTC acts. And I think all the states have statutes that mirror the deception and I believe also the unfairness aspects of the FTC Act. And I think the demand letter issue, this settlement, and Commissioner Wright and Commissioner Olhausen voted to accept that settlement, it was unanimous, was a case apparently where thousands of small businesses that used scanners were asked to pay up license fees of $1,000 per employee for allegedly violating rights inherent in some scanner patents held by this firm. And I won't go into the deceptive statements. I mean, the FTC discusses that. But this is, in my mind, a purely sort of factual analysis and one that state AG's offices could be very good at doing. It doesn't involve a lot of theorizing about economic impact and the appropriate return to a patent and whether competition is being diminished. It's sort of more bread and butter. And I think it goes back to the point that Commissioner Wright made, that contract law and patent law doctrines, for example, or tort law in this case, if not little FTC Act, one could even come up with tort law deceit theories, although I think little FTC Act cases are more promising. These can handle the problem. Do you really need more legislation to deal with issues that capable law enforcers can currently deal with, in my view, successfully?
Any final questions from the audience before we engage in a break and then the second panel? Yes, ma'am. There's a mic there that will help.
Can you hear me? No?
Barely.
There
we go.
Very good. Margot Torbett, retired IBM and the Patent and Trademark Office. My question is for Professor Abbott. As you know, IBM receives the greatest number of patents every year, including Priority State Street Bank. For 13 years, the Department of Justice brought an antitrust case against IBM, and after 13 years, finally dropped it. The cost to the taxpayers back then was millions of dollars. The cost to IBM was hundreds of millions of dollars. What, if anything, since they found nothing after 13 years, what, if anything, do you think should have been done to those at the DOJ who brought the case? And what, if anything, do you think can be done to prevent something like that from happening again?
Well, I think the case, the famous IBM case you're referring to, and by the way, thank you, a former student of mine, thank you, was widely viewed by commentators after the fact as a waste of resources. Assistant Attorney General Baxter early in the Reagan administration said this is the industry has changed enormously. Theories of competitive monopolization of bad individual conduct don't make sense here. I think the prosecutors from Justice were acting with the best of intentions, and it really isn't, I don't think you should take any action with regard to them, but what this underscores is the importance for good leadership that takes into account type one, type two error, false positives, false negatives, that takes into account the potential costs on the private sector of what they are doing, and particularly unilateral conduct, which has great potential to be efficient. You want to be very careful so as not to chill efficient conduct, knowing that the threat of prosecution can prevent a lot of other companies from engaging in innovative behavior. And in my view, I think the best approach to that, to having, you need simple rules and leadership that emphasizes sound economics, and not just pure theory, Professor Wright has made that point, good empirics, but also simple rules that try to eliminate unnecessarily theoretical cases where the risks of falsely accusing outweigh any potential risk of a benefit from bringing the case. And that was laid out beautifully by Professor and Judge, later Judge Frank Easterbrook, in his famous 1984 article, The Limits of Antitrust. He's written about that and spoken about that since then. And this idea of error cost, of law and economics constraining what prosecutors do is key, but it has to be the leadership of the agency that takes command. And to me, that's paramount.
It might be added that prosecutorial discretion in the civil and criminal contexts is an ongoing duty of public officials. So even if a case was properly brought, if through discovery and evidence assessment it becomes clear that the case is not going to be viable, is not going to be successful, then it's incumbent on those in charge of the litigation to end it when that becomes clear. So prosecutorial discretion isn't only at the outset, it's a continuing duty throughout the lifespan of litigation. Dean, do we have time for a break for these weary people before our second panel? Very good. We're in recess until 10 after for the new panel.
Thank you.